So some of you may have heard what happened to my son this past Shabbos and in Shul. So I'm not going to go through all the details. I'm just going to say in Rosh Hashanah, my son had strep throat without having any of the symptoms of strep throat, meaning nothing in his throat, nothing, no fever. He just had a stomachache, and normally a stomachache is just that. We all have the stomach flu last week, everybody in my family, so I assumed that it was just a continuation of that. So we didn't think it was anything big. So he did what he normally does, and he walked to Shul with me. And it's a long walk, we know that, and by the time we got there, he looked weak, but he didn't seem so bad. I told him to take a drink, so he seemed okay. But then what happened was during Kedusha of Musaf, so apparently the tune was not one to his liking, and he fainted backward, just pulled the chair with him and fainted backward. So at first, you sit there and you just say, okay, something happens. I looked around to go see what happened. I thought maybe he fell over, he tripped over something. But he was totally passed out, completely passed out. So I ran over to him, saw that his eyes had rolled up in the back of his head, and I yelled out loud, "Doctor, now!" The whole place is silent. The whole shul is completely silent. And Baruch Hashem, I go to a shul that has one doctor per every three people, so there's 750 doctors came by, and they grabbed him, they took his pulse, they realized that he was just he was weakened. There's no question he was dehydrated, but they didn't know what else it was. They had absolutely no idea. He has no history, nothing like that, no issues. He has asthma, but other than that, there's no other issues that this kid has. He's a perfectly healthy kid. So they immediately called 911, they called Etzela, they got everybody over there. We ended up he got into a stretcher. I had to run around, I was getting him Coke and then trying to tell him I had three kids there, I didn't know how I was going to get them home. it was a bit of a hassle, but within 7 minutes we were in the hospital and we were in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. Took his pulse, they got him on a little bit of an IV and they brought him into the hospital. So I had never had this happen before. I think I did when I was a little kid and I had a bunch of scars on my hands, so I had it, but I don't remember ever seeing it. And they bring you in, the ambulance pulls up right up to the hospital itself. They bring you in, they immediately wheel you in. And this is the first time where you go into an emergency room and there's doctors already there. They're waiting for you, they know what's happening. And they're worried, this is an 11-year-old kid. What could have happened to an 11-year-old kid for this to happen, for him to have had such a situation? Immediately ran through a gamut of tests. They did everything, absolutely everything. They looked at every part of his body, they touched everything, they felt everywhere, they took blood tests, they did an EKG, they did tons of tests, and within 10 minutes of when we had gotten to the hospital, they had done everything that you could possibly think of, and going through one after the other, until finally one of them thought to do a strep test. A strep test. They felt, it's amazing. And he had strep. And I said, there's no way he has strep. I said, there's no way. There's absolutely no way he has strep because he doesn't have any symptoms at all. There was nothing. No fever, no anything. He was perfectly normal. But he did. He had strep. He had dehydrated at the same time from the fact that he had strep and hadn't had any fluids in his body or hadn't had enough fluids in his body. And that dehydration with the strep made him pass out. Once that happened, you saw all the doctors. Just, you saw them like breathe. Saw them breathe. At first, it was this and that and the other. But it's now printed into my head, because I'm standing there, and I'm not worried, but yet nonetheless, you're a father, so of course you're worried. So as much as I'm saying, for those who are in my vod, I did say I love you, Hashem. I'm just calling that I probably had the best one. Okay, for those who are in the vod, that was right there. I did say it. But I don't remember at what point I said it. I will tell you, but it was definitely said. But as time was going on, I was watching the doctors, and I'm standing there, and I'm saying little to him to myself. I obviously didn't have a safe around me. I couldn't carry anything. But I'm standing there saying yelling to myself, and I'm watching the doctor. And you see the doctor, this lady, she's probably worked in the ER for 20 years, 25 years. And she's the most experienced there. There are other doctors, there are other nurses, but she's the most experienced. And she's going through, and she's checking things off in her head. You can literally see it as if she's checking things off in her head, like, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. And it's amazing. It's really amazing to watch these doctors do it. You have no information. information in front of you. Nothing. The kid fainted. There's nothing wrong. He doesn't have a history. There's nothing there in front of you. What are you supposed to do? And going through from one to the other, before the test even happened, she's going through. And when she said it, when she said, we're doing a strep test, you saw that one thing where she's like that light bulb, like coming off and coming out on top of her head and saying, like, that's it. That's exactly how it's supposed to be. It's got to be strep. They did the strep test. It came back 3 minutes later. It was positive. And then they all calmed down. They put on an IV and they realized, okay, he just needs to get fluids in his system. He'll be fine. He's got to get medicine. After that, he's going to be perfectly fine. And I can talk about this now because obviously everything turned out fine. He went to school yesterday and everything's good. Had it been a different story, it's a little bit different. Maybe I'd have a different experience. But I'm looking at this now. I'm saying, I see how these doctors do things. You can't just jump in and throw everything all at once. It's got to be one by one, step by step. You're looking at every single possibility and either saying yes or no, yes or no. Is this a possibility or is this not a possibility at all? Going one by one by one by one. Let's bring that into this parsha, this idea into this parsha. At the end of last week's parsha, we see the Akedah with Avraham Avinu. Beginning of this week's parsha, we see Sarai Avinu. We're seeing a contrast. It literally is a contrast behind how Avraham Avinu treats the Akedah and how Sarai Avinu treats the Akedah. Now consider the following. Avraham Avinu is told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to do something which is crazy, to sacrifice his own kid, and to take his kid and to bring him as a korban olah. And I do realize the similarities. I did speak about the akedah right before this all happened. But taking his own kid and to do an akedah in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu for that to happen. Sarai Avinu is told that the akedah happened. Now, Avraham Avinu's reaction is with simcha and zrizus of ready to go. I'm ready. He wakes up the morning. He saddled his donkey. He got himself ready to go. It's as if he's ready to go. He grabbed his kid and started to go. It's as if his servants are like running behind him saying, wait up. We'll come with you. That's how Avraham Avinu goes about the news that he's supposed to take his own child to be sacrificed. And Sarai Avinu's reaction is death. She's shocked and she dies. Now, Sarai Avinu was a greater nevuah, was greater in nevuah than Avraham Avinu. That's what the Gemara tells us. That's what it seems to be from the parsha itself. Kol, everything that Sarai Avinu tells you, Shema Bekola, listen to her voice, says the pasuk. So Sarai Avinu is at a higher level of nevuah. How is it, Shaykh, that Avraham Avinu was able to understand this plan and accept it more and in a better way than Sarai Avinu, or seemingly in a better way than Sarai Avinu? I've seen answers. The answers that are given are, some say that Sarai Avinu was on such a high level that the akedah for her caused her to die. That she was at such a high level that she attached herself to the Shekhinah and she couldn't release her neshama from the Shekhinah. She was so tremendously connected, she couldn't disconnect. I've seen that answer. I've seen the answers that Sarai Avinu was told bad news, told the wrong news. The wrong news, meaning you read the Rashi at the beginning of Chayei Sarah, you could read it the other way. That Sarah was told that the Akedah didn't happen and she thought that Avraham Avinu had failed the test that he saw him. And the fact that he failed is what caused her to die. She couldn't believe that he would have failed at such a... How could he not have sacrificed that child? But the pashut shot is that she died from hearing about the news. How could that have happened? So Chaim Shmulevitz, Sichos Musar, asked this question and says that the process was different. The process of the news that happened to Avraham versus the news that happened to Sarai Avinu. Avinu is told in a brilliant way by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. He said, he goes up to him and says, Kach no es bincha. Take your child. And Avraham Avinu's reaction, as we all know from the Gemara, is, I have two children. Do you want Yitzchak? Do you want Yishmael? He says, es echidcha. The only child of his mother. He said, Avraham Avinu, both are only children to their mother. There's Yishmael, there's Yitzchak. How do I know which one? He said, Asher ahavta, the one you love. He said, Avraham Avinu, I love both of my children. I don't love one more than the other. They're both my loved children. As Yitzchak. Okay. Yitzchak. See, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not go straight and say, sacrifice your child. In fact, when he said, it still wasn't saying, that didn't happen yet. Kadosh Baruch Hu slowly but surely brought him into the parsha to say, here's what you have to do. And Avner was getting used to it, and getting used to it, and getting used to it, and then told to bring up as a korban olah. Now that's a shocker, an absolute shocker. But he already got himself into, okay, this, and then that, and that. Once you're brought into the system, Kadosh Baruch Hu was telling him something, he was able to accept it with a more understanding heart. Saruman was told by either Og or Eliezer or the Satan, could be all three as one. He's told, she is told, Yitzchak was just sacrificed. That shocked her. It wasn't Abram went to Hara Moriah and he took his child Yitzchak and he brought Yitzchak up the mountain and he shafted him. That's not how it was said. It was Avram shechted Yitzchak. It's such a shock to her system. How could he have done such a thing? Where did that come from? Why would he do this? It's against everything that Avram Yenu stands for. Why would he have done such a thing? That shocked her to death. That's another way of answering the question. See, this is a mida, this idea. It's called histalgus, the idea of staglus, the idea of going step by step. Literally, if you want to translate the word, it translates to the word adaptation, to adapt to what's going on around you. But it applies in a different method when it comes to Musar. And the idea is to go step by step, to take it little by little, to not jump to the conclusion or jump to the next level, but take it little by little until you can get to the point where you want to be. And when a person jumps, that has to show them, it's like sorry, maybe, that it shocks you to death. If a person takes it little by little, step by step, you can get to that level, and it happens in a good way. The idea is that in time, you will become great. It's not that there's greatness thrust upon you and that you'll become great in 1 second. That doesn't happen to very many people. And when it does, usually it ends up going the opposite way. Usually it ends up being little by little by little. I know Lahavdil, a trillion Havdalos. I understand this. But think of what happens when basketball players make that first contract of $90 million. How many of them keep that money? How many of them have nothing left after a few years? I read an article about Mike Tyson once and the amount of money that this guy had. It is literally unbelievable how much money this guy had. Absolutely unbelievable. The only thing I compare it to is a guy that I'm friends with when I was in LA. I saw him, I met him, and I asked him about, he's working at a restaurant, and I said, tell me, have you ever seen anybody famous go into these restaurants? I wasn't expecting a big rep. So, have you ever seen anybody famous? And he told me he once saw Floyd Mayweather come inside. Okay? Floyd Mayweather. And Floyd Mayweather came in there, and he brought his whole posse. They double parked with all their Escalades, 3 or 4 Escalades. They double parked on the street, and they all came out, and they say he comes in and he's got a bag in one hand and he's always carrying with him over $500,000 in cash, and he's got it in a bag with him at all times. Now if you think, like, oh, why doesn't anybody steal it from him? You're talking about a guy who could literally kill a wall just by punching it. He's the only person who I would take him over the wall. You're dealing with that. Now, we're talking about a guy, and he's a little bit smarter than Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson spent it on Tigers and Lamborghinis for his friends who are no longer his friends. That's what he spent it on. Floyd Mayweather, he walked in and he came. He paid for everybody there to go to dinner. It was a $9,000 dinner. That's how much they spent. $9,000. And he gave, this is the paladins, he gave a $6,500 tip. $6,500 tip. You know what he did? Reached into the bag, pulls out a wad of bills, licks his finger, goes through, puts down $15,000 bills. I think he has them. Nobody else does. Puts them down. He says, are we cool? And the guy, my friend, was just like, yeah, cool. I'm done with that. That is 100%. If you're dealing with people, when they make this money all at once, they have no idea what to do with themselves. They have no clue. They have no idea. Literally no idea. Just read about the stuff that these people buy when they make money. Scottie Pippen bought a plane that didn't work. It didn't work. It went bankrupt a few years later. How do you do that? What kind of a person does that? Because these guys, you read about people that win the lottery, you hear about these things. If it goes slowly, slowly but surely, little by little, you're able to build yourself up and you're able to make yourself into something, you can do it. But if you just throw yourself into the frying pan and you're saying, like, you know what, I'm going to be a pancake. You're not going to be a pancake. That's not how it works. You got to do stuff. You got to flip it once, twice. I don't know. I never made a pancake. But I'm assuming that it doesn't just become a pancake just by throwing it inside the frying pan. That's not what happens. This concept is all over. You have this everywhere. The Gemara in Ksuvot, Sava Feis, is the most unbelievable Gemara, how the Chachamim would go out and they'd go to yeshiva for 12 years at a time. This is the famous Gemara. It includes Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva went for 12 years and then another 12 years. But the Gemara goes through a whole bunch of examples of different people went to yeshiva. One went to yeshiva after he got married for only a few years. He's supposed to go away for 7. He only stayed away for 3 or 4. And he came back. And his father came out with a sword and said, if you come back, I'm going to kill you. You don't come back. He just wanted to come back for one day. But that's it's an unreal Gemara, and it mentions Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinoy. Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinoy came back to see his wife after 12 years, and he walked into the house. He just walked in. He said, I haven't seen you in 12 years. Hey, honey, I'm home. And she was shocked, and she died. She died. She saw that he walked in, she passed away. Hanina ben Chachinoy, Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinoy said, how could I do this to my wife? She's been waiting so long for me. So she said to her, he said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is this the punishment that we give, the reward that we give to a person who's been waiting for me for 12 years? So she had Tchiyas HaMeisim. Brought her back to life. That's what the Gemara says. Now, others were, they actually learned from it. And the Tanoim understood, like, you know what, I'm not going to go home. I'm going to wait a little bit. I'm going to send a message that I'm back. And then afterward, we'll figure it out. I'll go back a little bit later. See, that's the smart way of doing it. There's a Maimer Chazal to knock on a door before you go in. To knock on a door before you go in. Halachically, you can't just walk into a house, even if it's your own home. You should knock on the door and then open up the door and walk inside. Because walking in is not the way we do things. When Eli was told that Bnei Yisrael had lost the war, that its children were killed, and that the Aron Kodesh had been taken captive by the Plishtim, when Eli HaKohen was told that, they went in little by little, and he still passed away. Because I'll tell us, it wasn't because they told him in the wrong way. In fact, the Gemara tells us that it was Shaul HaMelech who told over the news, and he did it in a very smart way. But Eli HaKohen was so shocked that the Aron Kodesh was taken, that he died only from the Aron Kodesh being taken away, not from the way the news was told. The news was told to him in the right fashion, in the right way. That's how you do it. Like David HaMelech, we see the same type of concept. There's an unbelievable Gemara, we all know it, regarding Hushim ben Dun, the Gemara in Sota. Hushim ben Dun is such a classic example, and it's possible this is the greatest example of such an idea of going one to the other way, literally two opposite ways. The Shvatim bring Yaakov Avinu over to Maris Machpelah. They bring him up to Maris Machpelah, and all the kings are there. 31 kings of Eretz Yisrael put their crowns on top of Paro's crown that's sitting on the kever of Yaakov Avinu as they're going through. The Mitzrim had the representatives, the Ishmaelim had the representatives, everybody's there. And Esav himself, leading his army, comes in front and said, it's my cave, I get to be buried here. Leah's inside there, Leah's my wife, I'm the one who's supposed to get it, I sold my Bechorah, I didn't sell my right to the cave, I want my spot in Maris Machpelah. The Shvatim said, no, when you sold the Bechorah, you sold the rights to the cave as well. He said, I want you to prove it. So apparently this is in writing, which is amazing. It answers a lot of shilas and how you're allowed to sell your birthright in the first place. If there was something tangible that he sold, like Maris Machpelah, then it allows you to sell the rights to the Bechorah as well. That's the assumption over here. But Naphtali was sent to go back down to Mitzrayim. Hushim ben Dun, who is deaf, was not able to hear what was going on, went up to one of his brothers, somebody, and said, what's going on here? What's happening? And they told him, they showed him, Esav is making complaints on Maris Machpelah. And Hushim ben Dun said, what? He's making a complaint and my grandfather is sitting in a bezayah because of that? Takes out his sword and cuts off Esav's head. Now anybody could have done that. You could have done that. If they were close enough that anybody could have taken out a sword and cut off Esav's head, they all should have done that. Why didn't Yehuda do it? Why didn't Naphtali do it? Why didn't anybody who was standing there, why wouldn't they have done it? The answer is, because each one of them had heard it little by little. What are you doing? We're burying Yaakov Avinu. Where are you burying him? Mars Machpelah. Mars Machpelah is mine. Mars Machpelah is not yours. You sold it. No, I never sold that. I sold something else. They had already gotten used to it. It's part of their system already. They had heard it. And when they heard it, it wasn't a shock to them that he had complained about Mars Machpelah, that Mars Machpelah wasn't there. The people were already into it. Hushin ben Dun had no idea what was going on. And all of a sudden he hears that Esav's making a complaint. Esav, he doesn't have the right. He immediately cuts off his head. There's no question. When that shock hits in, when it's thrown in, how could you? I can't believe it. I can't believe such a thing could happen. You're going up to somebody and you're apologizing for something that you did. Let's say you hurt him really badly. You said something that you know you shouldn't have said, and you really hurt him really badly. You're expecting the apology to be accepted immediately? Don't. It's not the way these things work. You go up at first and you say, I know that this apology is not enough, but it's what I can do right now. And I'm going to keep working on it. I'm going to make it better. And then you go to the next time. I'm apologizing again. I thought it over again. And really, I think I'm more wrong than I thought I was. I want to work on it. You don't just expect. It's never going to happen overnight. When you're dealing with your wife, and you have an issue that might have come up, which you said something wrong, you did something that you shouldn't have done, whatever it is, there's an apology, and then the wait. You wait a little bit. You add on to it. You add on to it. You can't. It doesn't happen this way. It doesn't happen that you go. This is the idea of taking that one step at a time. And this is the idea of what happens when you have a Hushim ben Dun versus everybody else being involved over there. This Medrash is going to answer one final question. I look back. I'll be honest with you. I have a very, very difficult time, and I've mentioned this before, reading Holocaust books. I just can't. And it's for a bunch of reasons. One of them being, I can't believe this actually happened. And number two, I find it hard. I just don't understand how people survived. I don't get it. I'd like to think that I have that level of Mesiras Nefesh. I'd like to think that when I say Shema, I'm thinking to myself that yes, I'm willing to give up my life to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but to be tortured the way they were tortured, I can't read it. I just can't read it. I can hear the stories that were how the person was saved, but to hear what happened in all these different places, forget Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, all the areas, they scare the living daylights out of me. I can't do it. It's too difficult for me, and I try. I really, really try. I find it too much. So how did they survive? How did these people do it? How do you have anybody surviving such atrocities, crazy, crazy atrocities? Forget about staying from. Let's keep that out to the side. How do you live? How do you not commit suicide? How do you not just go on a hunger strike until you die? And I realize that you'll probably say, well, my need to survive supersedes or is stronger than my ability, I guess, than my coping mechanisms that I have available to me. I don't know. Maybe that's so. I think this is the method that's necessary for this to happen. If the Nazis in Auschwitz put them in the concentration camps all at once, without there being any in-betweens, I think many more people would have died of shock than anything else. But they have been brought through level by level by level. Meaning they've been brought into ghettos and then slowly but surely taken into train cars and then taken into concentration camps. When your expectations are that low, you can't expect to have anything more. You've lowered yourself to where it's just not there. That's this concept of these toggles. The concept of being able, it's a coping mechanism, It's an ability to survive, and it's also a method for us to be able to become great, for us to realize how great we can be. To go day by day and say to myself, today I'm doing this, tomorrow I'm doing that, I'm working on myself. This week I'm working on this, next week I'm working on that, this month I expect myself to be here, next month I expect to be there, and even year by year. This year I'm doing this, and next year I want to do that. I want to build myself up. I want to make myself better by strengthening myself in the things that I already know that I'm good at, and making myself better so that I just keep going and not stop. Not stop. I want to keep going. And when there's a setback, don't worry. I can build myself up off of that as well. I know I can get a little bit. And sometimes the setback is because I jumped too far. So I'm going to take it easier this time. This time I'm just going to take the little step instead of taking the big step and possibly falling backward a little bit. That's the concept. It's such an important concept in yeshiva, especially during a winter's month, especially in a longer winter's month with an agar beis. Such a huge level. We should be zocha to understand this and to really take ourselves step by step and little by little bring ourselves to become the tzaddikim that we know we all are, and to really, really build ourselves up. We can do it. We just have to do it. We just have to take it little by little and don't jump too far.